General Menezes, Reel 9. We were talking about your time as the Assistant Adjutant General at Army Headquarters India at New Delhi between November 47 and into 1952, I think it was in the end. We were talking about the Indian National Army question, the treatment and status of the prisoners or former prisoners.
So some of the people who joined the INA had, during the war, said that they had managed to escape and come back with information. So the British had lauded them and given them MBEs and things like that, awarded them MBEs. But the point I'm trying to make is that there were others who had encouraged these people, others in the INA, their superiors, who had encouraged them to desert the Japanese and cross over into India, who the British would not accept had helped these people or initiated these people's escape. You see. So I felt that kind of injustice was there in amongst the British. Not that they were going out of their way to be unjust, but from the point of view of not seeing both sides of the matter. If they had given awards to these people, like MBE to a chap called Mahavir Singh Dhillon, now dead, who had come across, that was the first time that the British knew that an Indian National Army had been created. They did not know it had been created. So when Mahavir Singh Dhillon came across, he was lauded as a hero. But now there was, for example, a Lieutenant Colonel N.S. Gill at that time, who in terms of the seniority pattern, he was Sandhurst. Mahavir Singh Dhillon was also Sandhurst, but in terms of the pattern, N.S. Gill would at independence have been a Major General immediately. Now, I found that the attitudes of the Indian officers also, some of them were for him to be brought back as an example. But I mean, his friends favored that. But there were others who were not his friends, but who had lost a position in the rat race. And they were not so amenable to his coming in, shall we say.
What did you think?
No, I did not. I mean, we could only bring it to the notice of the government because I had to defer to the views of my superiors. I was only a cog in the wheel. I could go out of my way to get Lockhart here before he left for Britain and help Cumming, but I could not go out of my way in every case because I was not Don Quixote or something tilting at windmills all the time. It looked like that. But anyway, so Nehru then took the decision that people that the army did not take back and he felt that they had been victimized, he then took them into the Foreign Service. So N.S. Gill, the example that I'm giving, was sent as an ambassador to Ethiopia. And similarly, the secretary of the INA, so-called relief committee, who would, in normal circumstances, have been a lieutenant colonel or full colonel, he was sent as a first secretary and later retired as an ambassador, that kind of thing. Then there was the question of ceremonial. Now, it was not possible for me to handle courts martial plus INA plus ceremonial, for example, Gandhi's death. Now, I had to handle that in addition to my duties when he was assassinated on 30th of January. Now, that was not an easy task, but because Gandhi was a personality revered by the people, the crowds didn't, though Lord Mountbatten was later to say that he'd never seen such gigantic mourning. But nevertheless, it was not an indisciplined crowd.
How did you? I mean, you didn't deal with it personally then, did you?
No, I had to issue the orders to headquarters, what was called Delhi area. Just like you have London district over here.
What sort of orders did you issue? Do you remember the gist of them?
No, well, the gist was briefly was that all possible assistance would be rendered to the civil authorities in organizing this. But in events like this, it ends up ends up at the army doing everything. That's what happens. You see, here you don't have the population problem or the crowd problem that we have in India. Population is over 1 billion today. So Delhi was given the orders, and any help that they wanted by troops moving in or otherwise. So we moved some troops in from the adjacent cantonments. The whole route was lined by troops in order to control the crowds. The usual gun carriage is provided for the body, and it went off without any incidents.
But any other ceremonial things you recall?
No. At this point of time, I stated that they must have a separate ceremonial section. Separately, I was also dealing with welfare.
And so tell me about that. What was the welfare side of your work?
As I say, I was supposed to do it, but I decided not to do it. And the welfare was largely of resettling these people who lost their land and their families in what is West Pakistan. Because by circumstance of this martial races, martial classes theory, a very large percentage of your Indian army consisted of North Indians, mainly Sikhs. At that point of independence, Sikhs were 28% of the army, though they are only 2% of the population. So there was a question of getting resettlement schemes, land, and all that for these people. And a particular problem was getting, shall we say, once you got the land in Delhi, then the corruption starts of people faking their documents as to whether they are refugees or not. So I refused to get involved in this corruption. So a new section of the Lieutenant Colonel was created with this task of welfare, and a major and a captain that I had was sent off. The major was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel, and he took over responsibility for welfare. And in due course, another section was created for ceremonial, and the staff concerned in my setup were then sent to the ceremonial section.
So you were left largely with disciplined court martials?
Well, disciplined courts of inquiries, because now the indiscipline of the Indian Army was coming out. The cases of people who there was what is called a military evacuation organization, who were supposed to, shall we say, escort refugees from Pakistan to India. And some of the people, in order to give space in the military vehicles that were being used. After all, the military vehicles their numbers were finite, not infinite. So they were accused of asking for jewelry and items like that. So there was a spate of these cases resulting from the military evacuation period from Pakistan to India. Then the cases actually started flowing from the Kashmir operations, because the Indian troops had to be flown in to Kashmir. So if there were allegations against the tribesmen for their depredations, the local Muslims would come up with allegations of their own against the Indian troops. So it was not we were all the time having some court martial or court of inquiry on account of the problems of Kashmir.
Now, what's the next thing you remember then of your time? You were there quite a long time, weren't you? It looks here like you were there to September 52.
Yes, I mean, virtually I had virtually become indispensable, because I was doing a one-man kind of show. Because, as I said, I sent off staff to create the welfare section. I sent off staff to create the ceremonial section. My number two was a British, British civilian officer, because the British had in army headquarters, as a result of their 1857 experience, preferred to take in people from the ranks preferably British, to in the clerical cadre in what was then the GHQ and Defence Department. So I had this civilian staff officer, grade 2. Now he had been conscripted during the war and had risen to the rank of acting lieutenant colonel. So shall we say he was my number 2. And now I was quite happy to keep him on. But then his son, who joined the Royal Navy, died in a vehicle accident at Singapore. His own marriage had broken up, so he was quite shattered. So he decided to resign. So for a long period, I had a bed in my office, and I lived and worked from the office for months, clearing up the areas, because after all, I was supposed to have arrived in August, and I only arrived in November. So massive areas were there. So it literally can be said that I lived and worked in my same room with a bed discreetly lodged in the office.
Hard work, then.
Well, I mean, it was a very difficult period. I was rewarded for it in as much as I was a lieutenant colonel out of turn. But to some extent, I had become indispensable. Now, then the question arose that I could have wangled a vacancy to Staff College at Independence, but I didn't. I chose to do it the honorable way. I was sitting for the examination. So I'd wanted to sit for the examination in 1950, but I fell ill and had an appendicectomy. So I eventually sat for the examination, Staff College examination in 1952. I came first in the examination, and I went to Staff College, where I came first on the staff course. The Staff College was commanded by one of the last British officers in India.
Now, hang on. So this you went to the staff. It was called the Defence Services
Staff College
at Wellington.
Wellington in the Nilgiris. You see, the British had named the newer cantonments where there were no township after military heroes like Wellington.
So you went there from October 52 to October 53. It was a 1-year course.
Yes, it's a 1-year course.
Now what do you remember of that course? What exactly were they training you? Can you give us an idea?
I'd already been a staff officer, but insofar as my military progression was concerned, it was necessary for me to have done the staff course. This Defence Services Staff College was an inter-services staff college, the only one in the Commonwealth, or shall we say, a coalition or whichever way you like it. Because the army here has its own staff college, the Air Force has their own staff college, the Navy here has their own staff college, but as an economy measure, to the credit of this Major General Lentaine, who was the last British officer to serve in India, who had been in the Chindits, he had favoured to reduce overheads of having a Defence Services Staff College. India, in any case, had been ahead of the other countries when they set up for the initial cadet training in a place called the National Defence Academy near Pune. That had been conceived in British days, you say, by sending a team around the world. So we were ahead of other nations from that point of view, but we were also driven by economy.
So it's combined services. Now, tell me what you learned. What was the nature of the course?
The nature of the course was as a staff officer in the army, but also to have an understanding of the other two defence services. So there were written exercises, outdoor exercises, so-called national tour, where we visited certain defence establishments, went to sea with the Navy on a cruise, saw Air Force demonstrations. In order to have a staff officer with an integrated approach. And Lentaine was a good commandant, as I say. He had been the director of military operations at Independence in the then GHQ. He had been a brigade commander in the Chindits under Wingett, for whom he had no time. He didn't like Wingett. He thought that he was a total, shall we say, moron in many ways, which Wingett was, because we were, as I say, I did my first battle course, experimental battle course, with Royal Marine Commandos adjacent to the Chindits. And of course, we did get these visions of Wingett walking around naked for the whole day, so-called toughening himself with an alarm clock tied around his waist, so that he would set the time on the alarm clock to remind him as to what the next appointment was, that kind of thing. So he was an eccentric. I'm not saying his greatness from other points of view. Churchill thought very highly of him. But nevertheless, insofar as the Indian Army was concerned, Wavell didn't think very highly of the Indian Army. And he said so at Quebec when he attended the Quebec conference.
Now, can you give us an idea of some of the exercises you were doing on the course? What were you actually doing?
Well, they're called tactical exercises without troops. So you have the various operations of war, that is, advance, attack, defense, and withdrawal. And so you have a series on each one of those. So you start off with your textbook study, then you do a tactical exercise with troops on the ground. And so we did not have any troops, we would have what is called a telephone battle.
How did that work?
Well, in a hall, you have a complete appointments, shall we say, in a division. And so I was the divisional commander for one of the telephone battles, and I'd have to give orders as if I was a major general in the field. And the so-called written operational orders would then have to be issued. And then you would have the so-called enemy who would then react to whatever you are doing. So it is a two-sided exercise, but without actual troops, but with actual human beings functioning with telephones or communications.
Did you work in syndicates like the British Staff Colleges did?
Yes, you work in syndicates.
How did the syndicates work? Can you give us an idea? Tell us how it worked in practice.
The course is divided into syndicates. Each syndicate has a directing staff. At that time, we had Lieutenant Colonels as directing staff. A person like myself was already Lieutenant Colonel as a student. So the basic thing is what they call a précis on various subjects or facets, like advance, attack, defense, withdrawal, foreign countries, various other facets which you come up in life. And so those précis or publications, you go through them chapter by chapter in syndicate discussions. That's your basic program. And then you progress, shall we say, as I gave you an example, defense, you progress from the syndicate discussion of the précis on defense or the pamphlet on defense, you then progress to a tactical exercise without troops. Then from a tactical exercise without troops, you progress to a telephone battle. But your syndicate is maintained for the tactical exercise without troops, the same syndicate. But then it is broken up for the purpose of the telephone battle, because each one of us is given a different appointment.
Did you feel you benefited? Did you good? You'd had a fair amount of staff experience already, but did you feel it was a really good course? Or
yes, I thought it was a very good course. We had a very good commandant in Lentain who could speak with authority on various operations that he had been in Burma, and he could also speak with authority on his own regimental, shall we say, traditions. But he was a very, he's a very positive man. I thought he was a very great man. But it broke his heart when after 5 years after independence. I mean, he was there till the end of our course and beginning of next course. But so he was given an, so 5 years after independence and 1 year's extension. But after that they said an Indian had to take over, which of course was inevitable. But he, that broke his heart. He arrived back in Britain and died. So he was Fort Gurkhas. He had no time for Wingate, under whom he had served, and from whom he had taken over when Wingate was killed in the crash. But at the same time, the people who had started with Wingate initially had no time for Lentaing. But that is the same story all over the world with all human beings. You disagree with your successor, you disagree with your superior, so and you find, but the, by and large, the average officer does not agree with his predecessor either.
Now, you passed out well.
I passed out first in the course.
Now, how many were there on the course?
120.
So that does mark you out as a real prospect. I mean,
yes, as you will see, what I gave you, that I was out of turn promotion right through. So I was the senior most lieutenant general in the Indian Army. Unfortunately, we only have one general. That is in order to keep down the military dictatorship pattern that Pakistan has gone in for, or other countries in the neighborhood have gone in for. So Pandit Nehru favored that you didn't have too much brass on top.
Well, we will come to this when we get a little further on. So now, so you left there in October 53, and what was to be your next posting?
There a bit of a dodge or the was played out on me, in the sense I was transferred from my regiment to another regiment, the Assam regiment.
The Assam?
Assam regiment. On the plea of adjusting seniority. That is, the Assam regiment was a newly raised wartime regiment. So therefore they did not have, shall we say, the argument was a requisite pattern of seniority in the regiment. But of course the real reason was that the then military secretary who had come to the staff college to address us and give the postings, he had just become the colonel of the Assam regiment. So he was favoring himself in a way, because the battalions of the Assam regiment had been declared unfit by comparison with the other battalions of the Indian Army. Now, his interpretation was that two officers should be brought in from outside to each battalion in order to put some backbone or efficiency into them. So I was one of the people who were brought into the Assam regiment. I don't grudge the experience, because I gave me experience of people from the Northeast who I thought were fine people and were largely misunderstood in many ways.
Now, you went to the 3rd Battalion?
3rd Battalion of the Assam Regiment.
And where were they? They were in the...
They were at that time on the East Pakistan border. They had been deployed. And
what was the region called? Did it have a name or just these...
No, I mean, the places had odd names like Katihar, Kalyaganj, and that kind of thing. But so it was on the East Pakistan border, and then we were brought back before moving out to the Punjab to a place called Muzaffarpur.
Now, what were you doing on the East Pakistan border? What was the role of the unit?
No, the East Pakistan border, we were, shall we say, just to prevent infiltration or exfiltration, whichever way you want to put it. Because at that particular period of time, in 1953, there was the fear of war with Pakistan. So concentration had taken place both in West Punjab and here as a precautionary measure. Because, let's face it, what all said and done, India has been the victim of Pakistani aggression right through. The British, for some reason, seemed to favour the Pakistani viewpoint because the British seemed to feel that the underdog deserves consideration. And Pakistan should never have been created. It is a total mistake. It has not solved any problems. But nevertheless, the British chose to take the easier route. And as I have said, Jinnah on his deathbed in September 48 wanted the two countries to reunite, because India has more Muslims. India has more Muslims despite partition than Pakistan has. So what was the purpose of creating Pakistan? India has the largest Muslim population in the world after Indonesia. But nevertheless,
was anything actually happening then on the East Pakistan border at the time you were there? Or was it just basically, it was a concentration and you were attending to border duties?
No, East Pakistan border, it was largely a question of infiltration and exfiltration, in the sense that if we go back a bit, what is called the insurgency in the Northeast, actually it was initiated by Pakistan and China. China and Pakistan have been friends. China on the basis, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The enemy of my friend is my enemy also, that kind of thing.
I know what you mean.
So, I mean, that may be Mao Zedong's philosophy. So, I have personal knowledge that when I went to the Assam regiment and had dealings with some of these Nagas, and I was told that Ayub Khan, who later became the dictator in Pakistan, was the first GOC in East Pakistan. Now, he had served in the Assam regiment. He had been posted to the Assam regiment in 1944 when the battalion had withdrawn under Japanese pressure towards Kohima. The CO had been killed, then the second command had taken over, and Ayub Khan had been posted as the new second command prospective CO. So that was 1944. And he promptly declared the battalion unfit for war.
Now, can you talk about that? I mean, what state was the battalion in when you got to it?
No, so I'd like to finish this.
Sorry, okay.
I'd like to finish this about the fact of the problems in the Assam regiment. So you had the various major tribes like Nagas, Manipuris, Lushais, or Mizos in the battalion, and it was not that the people were bad, but politics had been played with them by the Chinese, by the Pakistanis, and to that extent, many of them did not know where their loyalty was. There was a character called Fizo, for example, who had joined the Japanese, and then when the Simon Commission had come in 1931, these people had petitioned the British government that the Naga should be given independence. Now, 400,000 people can scarcely be given independence. But Ayub Khan, when he was GOC, played up this, because some of the men who had been ex-servicemen with him came and met him in Dhaka. So the situation there was very complex. Anyway, since your question is about Third Assam,